Hello and welcome to Talking Property with CBRE. I'm Catherine House, your podcast host, and in this episode, I'm checking in with Australian hotel entrepreneur Paul Fishman of 8 Hotels.
There were certainly deals that I signed that I had a funny feeling about, that I knew that I was going to have to climb a mountain to make them work and to even just to get out of them alive.
Paul has a fascinating story. He started his career straight out of school, began running boarding houses and hostels before launching his boutique hotel group. Some of his other ventures include Unyoked, which builds off-the-grid wilderness cabins, and Tipsy, an online hospitality training platform.
I always believe that what you put out in this world is what you get back. I mean, Paul talks about luck, and I was very lucky and fortunate that as a hotel GM, my hotel was sold and I became a hotel broker. And I've managed to meet so many amazing people like Paul. You know, it's a really lifelong journey.
I'm also joined by Wayne Bunns, a national director in CBRE's Australian Hotels team. Wayne recently sold Brisbane's Mantra Terrace Hotel, in which Paul was an investor. The sale to the NRL achieved a 42% uplift on its 2021 purchase price. Wayne is going to give us his take on Paul's journey, Australia's boutique hotel market, and some of the latest Australian hotel investment trends. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, Paul, welcome to Talking Property.
Thank you, Catherine.
And Wayne, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Catherine, and thank you, Paul, for taking the time to share your journey with us.
My pleasure.
So, Paul, perhaps to kick us off, can you tell us how you started out? I believe it involved being mentored by a property wheeler dealer.
I did, and I was mentored by a property wheeler dealer. I was very luckily introduced to a guy called Michael Teplitsky, and Michael was only a few years older than me at the time. He was already doing some really incredible deals in the property space primarily. He was building units all over Sydney. He was buying and selling commercial buildings, and he also owned a hotel. And I begged him for the chance to follow him around, and he eventually agreed, and I spent a year with him. And the first few months of that year, our offices were in this hotel. And so I got a bit of exposure to the hotel industry through this hotel. And through that period, which lasted for about 12 months, I also got exposure in property development and construction and finance. And it was a very sort of dynamic and fast-moving environment that Michael and a whole other bunch of young and dynamic and now very, very successful property wheeler dealers, we're all working together and doing some pretty special things. And so that was my entree into work and into the hotel world.
It's like a property incubator.
It was. Yeah. It wasn't very corporate, but it definitely was an incubator of sorts, definitely.
So, Wayne, you've done numerous hotel deals with Paul over the years. Can you give me a sense of how much of an impact Paul has had on Australia's boutique hotel sector during his time in the industry?
Yeah, look, I think that Paul was probably at the forefront of running smaller properties with smaller room counts and probably smaller actual size rooms. I think, Paul, what was your first hotel that you had?
Well, the first hotel that I took over was the Altamont Hotel, which was a 14-room boutique hotel in Darlinghurst, a really cool little property. But I actually had closed my first deal about a year earlier than that, which was a hotel that became the Pension Hotel in Sydney, and that was in George Street. And that came about because prior to that, I had been leasing buildings and running them as backpacker hostels, and I had a few boarding houses as well. And there was massive demand coming through the backpacker hostels for private rooms. And there was this vacant building, beautiful heritage building, vacant on the upper floors, retail on the ground and a pub on the ground. And an agent friend of mine knew that I was out there looking for more buildings, and he offered me the upper floors to do a backpacker hostel. And I said, well, look, let's do a hotel instead because I'm getting a lot of demand for private rooms. So the idea was just carve up this building into as many small rooms as possible and make sure that we have ensuite bathrooms in each room. And I was sure that I would fill it up. And so that property took about 4 years from the first meeting to discuss it with the owners and my landlords and actually opening the hotel.
And how many deals have you done, Paul? How many hotels have you been in and out of, whether it was a lease or whether it was a freehold going concern, and or perhaps things like Little Albion in Surry Hills that you actually designed and constructed yourself?
You know what? I'd have to count it up, but it's 25 or more possibly, probably around 25 hotels.
And it's interesting in property, you know, as agents and as observers, we often see the successful stories with hoteliers. Has it always been successful? Has there been times that you've made a decision and went, wow, how am I going to chew hard enough to make this thing work?
You know what? I was really quite fortunate because when I started off, the first couple of hotels that I did were in the Darlinghurst Kings Cross area, and that was in the early 2000s. And you had an enormous number of rooms that were taken out of the market because of the Sydney Olympics. And so these early hotels that I opened ran really, really well. There was just a lot of demand. And then I think that the market was really strong right up until sort of the GFC. So as I was expanding out the business, we had a really good run. The GFC really didn't do a lot of damage to the Australian hotels. There was sort of a 3 to 6 month period, which was pretty scary, but things kind of rebounded pretty quickly after that. And so I had a good run. But yes, there were certainly deals that I signed that I had a funny feeling about, that I knew that I was going to have to climb a mountain to make them work and to even just to get out of them alive, let alone on top. So I took a lot of risk when I was young, and I signed some pretty crazy leasing deals, particularly because I didn't start with any capital. And at that point, there weren't many other hotel owners that wanted me to manage hotels for them. So in order for me to grow a footprint, I had to be prepared to take on the risk of leasing, which I did. And I managed to get out of everything really quite nicely, but there were definitely some scary times and some massive challenges. And every deal that I did has a really interesting story behind it, how it happened and how I got my hands on them and all of that. So yeah, when I look back, I mean, it was really a very colourful career.
So you've run some of the country's best-known boutique hotels, the Kirkton in Darlinghurst, the heritage-listed 1888 Hotel in Pyrmont, the Felix Hotel near Sydney Airport. What do you think was your best investment? You've obviously climbed some mountains, but what was the most successful climb?
You know, they really were all different, and it's quite hard to answer that question as a general question. You know, obviously, some were financially better than others. Some I enjoyed more than others. Which one was the most? I mean, it's really hard to answer.
Paul, I want to jump in and ask a question there. You were Paul Fishman of 8 hotels. Where did the 8 come from? Hotel 1888.
I was thinking that too.
And I want to talk about your telephone number.
Yeah, yeah. No, the telephone number had a massive part in why the business is called 8 Hotels, but there's a few reasons. So many, many years, even before I started in the hotel stuff, I was doing the backpackers and mobile phones were still a fairly new thing. And I had a problem with the phone company and I rung them up and I said, I want a new number. And they offered me a number. I said, no, not good enough. And then they offered me another one. And I said, no, not good enough. I was just playing cool. And then they offered me this number that has lots of 8s and 3s in it. So I took it, not knowing that the 8 represented sort of luck and fortune in feng shui with the Chinese. And some years later, when I was sitting negotiating the deal that became the Pension Hotel, I had a Chinese landlord developer. And they, at the end of the first meeting, I think were fairly impressed with me. But when they asked for my contact details and I showed them my number, they said, oh, you have a very lucky number. And I actually think that that went some way into helping me secure the deal. But what clinched the deal was that I needed some funds. I need some capital for this deal. And I had approached somebody who I became very close with and still very, very close with, a man named Warwick Suskind. And Warwick had a fashion company called Table 8.
Ah, yes. I used to buy Table 8 clothes.
Exactly. Yes, it was a big, big business. And Warwick became my partner in that hotel. And so when I decided, after I had acquired 3 different boutique hotels with 3 different names, and I decided that I wanted to build out a hotel management company, I thought I should put a sort of an umbrella brand over the 3 hotels that I had. And I came up with the name 8 Hotels. And that's how it happened.
So you've been a bit of a trendsetter in the boutique hotel space. You mentioned 1888 before, the world's first Instagram hotel when it launched in 2012, 2013. So there were Instagram images taken by guests, free nights to anyone who posted stuff, who had more than 10,000 followers. At Felix, you established it as a plane spotter's heaven with telescopes to get an even closer view of the airport. How important is it, do you think, to have a point of difference in the hotel game?
Yeah, look, first of all, I'd say that a lot of the stuff that we did was really through necessity and luck rather than strategy, particularly in the early days. But as I got more experience and I was able to craft the hotels, obviously particularly the new hotels, but even refurbish some of the older hotels, I started coming up with the idea of trying to create a bit of a story in my mind behind the hotel and then use that story to design and to give a bit of a soul to the hotel. And that was really, though, just an sort of a personal thing that I got a kick out of doing. And so those hotels that you mentioned, for example, 1888, the name of the building was a beautiful old heritage Woolstore building that was built in 1888 and had a sign up there. And the eights were obviously quite special to me. But we sort of took the expression of the old Sydney 1800s kind of feel and look. And so the marketing and everything else sort of developed in that way. And then the design, the interior design sort of went along with that. But the Instagram thing was just a very clever PR firm that I used. And Instagram was just becoming a thing. And then they suggested that we should have this Instagram campaign. And I knew very little about Instagram at the time because it was 2013, I think it was. But it was the right place at the right time. So the world's press picked it up as the world's first Instagram hotel, whatever that means. It didn't actually mean anything.
You've got to have a world first is awesome.
Exactly. You know exactly, Catherine, as a journalist, you know. But what happened was that within a space of a few weeks, every major news organization on the planet was writing about this hotel. So it was very, very lucky, very fortunate. It was a really beautiful hotel.
And free marketing.
Totally free marketing. But the guests loved the hotel because it was a gorgeous hotel. And by then, I mean, even in the early days, culturally, we had developed a really great business and people loved working with 8 hotels. And so that feeling came through to our guests and it was very, very quickly, very, very successful. And the Felix Hotel, we asked the architect to come up with sort of a look and feel for the exterior. And they just, for whatever reason, came up with this kind of 1950s, 60s looking building, which was quite interesting considering it was 2015 or whatever it was that we started on it. And then from then I thought, oh, well, what if we did like make the theme like the golden years of flying in the 1960s? And one of our partners, his name was Felix. And I thought, wow, Felix is a great name for that. And so he didn't want it to be called Felix, but I said, no, we're calling it Felix. And then that's sort of then if you looked at the marketing that we did back then and the design and everything else, it was all based around that theme and all the collateral was based around that. So it was a mixture of just luck, timing, and also creating a bit of a story behind each hotel before we embarked on it.
So Wayne, what are your thoughts on that front? You know, is there a secret sauce in making a boutique hotel successful?
Look, the first thing I want to say to Paul is he's mentioned the word luck and right time, right place. You know, that's all very relevant. We all enjoy that success, but he's also a very smart entrepreneurial thought provoking and doing things and backing himself when probably many others didn't. And, you know, the word boutique hotel can be very overused. I mean, Paul's hotels were very extreme and very boutique, but he was also a very good operator and learnt very quickly. I suppose one of the successes I want to say to Paul, and we've got a lot of people listening to this podcast, we hope, that are in the real estate sector, whether they be in hotels or not. I think what Paul exemplifies is that no market ever runs forever. We all think it does. No market in Sydney is the same year on year, decade on decade, Melbourne and Brisbane. And Paul has played in all of those three markets. And, you know, whilst I'm sure sometimes he says he might have sold an asset too early, I think Paul's philosophy of leaving a drink in it for the next bloke is very important. And I think, Paul, we should expand on that. And also noting a lot of my clients, I say, are really good hotel buyers, but they may be very poor hotel sellers. And that what I mean is they don't take advantage of the market. And, Paul, if you could talk us about a great journey, because You owned a hotel. The first deal we did was a hotel in Brisbane that we sold at the right time at the right place. And then several years later, we came back and I brought that opportunity to you to buy it back at a different time in a different market circumstance. And then we came to you, which we're talking about is the Mantra Terrace Hotel. We recently sold it for you. So if you could just talk about your success of looking at markets in and out, being the right buyer and the right seller, and how you came to be back into an asset that you had owned and sold.
Well, that hotel actually has a really interesting story. And I'll just give you the full background to it. I had a number of hotels in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra. I was really wanting to be in Brisbane. This was around 2009 or something like that. I went up to Brisbane. Bunty, I didn't meet you at that point, but I did meet a great guy called Rick Bird, who was a director, I think, of Ray White at the time. And Rick was fantastic. He took me around and we looked at a whole bunch of opportunities. And Rick was doing his own development stuff as well with Scott Hutchinson. And long story short, we didn't find anything. But some months later, Rick rung me and said, Paul, Scott and I have just bought a site. We're going to build a hotel for you. And we started negotiating for me to lease that property. And I couldn't get to the level that Rick and Scott wanted me to get to. But more importantly, there was another bloke that was prepared to get to that level. So very disappointing for me, but a deal was done with this other guy. But I knew that he wouldn't make it work. And it wasn't long after that, maybe a year or so after he opened, that he came to me, the tenant, and said, look, do you want to take this on? And there's a huge long story behind all of that, but ultimately I did. And then Rick and Scott decided that they wanted to sell the hotel. And because I had a very long lease, I became the obvious buyer. And we did a deal for me to buy that hotel. But then the market changed in Brisbane, to your point, Bunzi. And it changed pretty quickly because it was the end of the mining construction boom that happened in Queensland. And then Bunzi came along with a good deal, very good deal. And I grabbed it and sold that hotel. And a few years later, the guy that I sold that hotel to during COVID decided to put it back onto the market. And Bunzi rung me. And of course, I knew the asset really, really well. So we grabbed it really quickly. And I had a couple of partners with me in that because they had introduced me to another deal that we were looking at that Bunzi was selling. I ultimately decided to not go along with that one. But because we were in that one together, I brought these guys who I do business with together. And then we recently sold that. Bunzi sold it again. So we sold it, we bought it, and we sold it. And it's been a good couple of deals.
So Wayne, bought by the NRL, which I found quite interesting, one of their latest hotel acquisitions. Are we seeing more new players like the NRL getting into hotel ownership?
Look, I think I don't want to comment on the NRL strategies, but obviously they're trying to diversify income streams and buying hotels, you know, close by their locations where they're playing football. There is always new entrants coming into the market. I mean, I always think of the RACV. Many people would think, you know, the Royal Automobile of Victoria, you know, sooner rather than later, they won't have members because they won't have cars breaking down because we'll all have electric cars. They're a great example of an organisation that has diversified into other assets and now own a substantial list of assets and leisure destinations through New South Wales, Queensland, and particularly Victoria, where their membership database get to access. So the good thing about the hotel industry, it's always sexy, it's always exciting, and there's always new investors that want to come and play. You know, when we found Ghassan Abood, who ended up buying Paul's Hotel in Surry Hills and, you know, poured $600 million into the economy of Cairns, it's great that we're always looking for new entrants to come in. And, you know, the hotel industry is a pretty safe and reliable investment if you know what you're doing and you work hard. Paul, would you agree?
Oh, totally. There are always new entrants. It is a sexy business. And so there's a lot of ego at play, which...
Ego in real estate? No.
No, can you believe it? But particularly in hotels, you have a lot of wealthy privates, you know, who love the idea of owning hotels. But boutique hotels are difficult because they're niche. And they're probably the first ones to sort of suffer when things go a bit soft. And by the way, I mean, I didn't have any plan to get into boutique hotels. I did fall in love with accommodation because it's just sort of where I fell into from a very early age. But I ended up in boutique hotels because they were small. And because they were small, there were less people that wanted them. And I couldn't get my hands on the bigger ones. But it's tricky. But Bunzi is right. There is often a buyer pool that, you know, may not be quite as sensitive to returns as, you know, buyers of the larger properties.
So, Paul, in your career, there have been twists and turns along the way. You went from, you know, running more than 20 hotels, and then you decided you wanted to change tack. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, I can. Look, there were a number of reasons, and it started at the end of 2014, and there was a bit of a personal reason. I was turning 40 the following year, and I thought, oh, let's build the business for a couple of years and then at 40 work out what I want to do. And by then, a few things were becoming apparent to me. One was that the consolidation of the larger groups that we see now is very obvious, was already starting to happen. And I could sense that the deals, particularly on the management side, were becoming more and more competitive and harder for privates and small players like me to be able to compete with these big boys. And I thought that was going to continue. And I thought some of the deals that were being done were not great deals, but they suited these larger players because they were engineered differently to me. And so that was one reason. The other reason was I had a nationwide, in fact, we had some management contracts overseas, but you know, a lot of staff, you know, I think we had over 500 at one point, and hotels all over from Perth to Sydney. And I was getting tired. And then I think the third thing was that I realized that as much as I romantically loved the hotel industry and the management side of it and the brand building and the people side of it, I thought, you know, I think I could make a lot more money if I just focused on the real estate. And so I decided to progressively sell down, starting in late 14 with the Brisbane hotel that we were just talking about being the first one. And I wanted to maintain an infrastructure, a small infrastructure, because I wanted to continue on owning and developing hotels, but not as a network, just as deals came up that made sense to me. And if I decided to sell, I'd sell. If I decided to hold, I'd hold. I didn't achieve that. I ended up selling everything and ended up not having an infrastructure. But that was also a very lucky break for me because it was halfway through 2019 that I sold the last hotel. And then COVID hit a few months later. So that would have been very difficult.
Oh, timing is everything.
Timing is everything. And timing is luck in most cases. And so that's what I decided to do. And I'm very comfortable with that decision. You know, I think operating businesses, particularly in Australia, is not easy. You know, labor costs are high, taxes are high. Red tape is very red. You know, so ultimately it was the right decision. I think that in order for me to have wanted to continue and to compete against the bigger players, I probably would have needed to have brought in some big capital. And I already had enough stakeholders within my world, and I'm fairly independent. So I thought, oh, do I really want to bring in someone else to my orbit? And the answer was no.
And so you've moved in a few different directions. I mentioned Unyoked at the beginning and also Tipsy. Is that what's taking up a lot of your time now? And why did you get involved with those groups?
Yeah, look, it's these are investments that I've made behind people and ideas. And the two that you mentioned are really quite exciting. Unyoked, I only have a small investment in. I wish I could have put more into that one, but the boys didn't want it. And it's run by a couple of brothers who are just really great operators. And it's sort of this off-grid cabin detox technology experience. It's super authentic and very, very cool. And the guys are now in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. And that's exciting. And Tipsy is an online hospitality training platform. And there's a remarkable CEO behind that, a guy called Jono Plowright. And Jono has overcome such obstacles to build a worldwide business, customers, hotel customers from all over the and restaurants and venue operators and caterers and so forth all over the world. And that's doing really, really well. And then I've also invested behind a young guy who has developed a really dynamic up-and-coming hotel contract cleaning and linen company called Ozone Hospitality Services. And I am much more hands-on with that one because it really is very close to what I used to do with running the hotels. And I'm really enjoying watching a young guy's name is Julanka building this business. He's a young guy and he reminds me of myself when I was at the same age. He's got a lot of grit and he's smart and he's really focused on actually providing a really great service. And that was my ethos in the hotels, was really trying to impress every guest that we had. And he does the same for his clients. So these are just investments within sort of the space that keep me close to it and are enjoyable.
So Wayne, as we start wrapping up, I really wanted to ask you about what your thoughts are on hotel investment activity this year. CBRE's latest hotel report seems to suggest that we're on track for a full recovery by the end of this year. Our latest APAC Hotel Investor Intention Survey shows more investors are planning to get into this sector, and Sydney was named as the second most popular city. Do you think 2025 is going to be a pivotal year for Australia's hotel market?
Yeah, look, sure. As a firm, we had a number of large deals that didn't get transacted last year that have hung over into this year. So we as a team will be making some serious announcements in the next quarter. There's always genuine pent-up demand from buyers for hotels. The biggest challenge we have is people not wanting to trade their assets. As we know in Sydney, everybody would want to be in Sydney, but trying to convince an owner to sell. If we got a VP, vacant possession hotel in CBD, Sydney, it would almost be take a number without having to do inspections to sell it. We're experiencing the same situation in Brisbane. You know, we've been lucky that we've sold the majority of hotels in this market up here for the last 8 years. Our biggest challenge is trying to convince owners to sell and meet the market. Melbourne, I think there'll be substantial more transactions in Melbourne over the coming 2-3 years as it continues to absorb the new supply. But I think, as Paul would say, hotels genuinely can trade on sharper yields than passive investments such as retail and office. But I think Paul would agree the ability to make a far more substantial capital gain on a hotel transaction versus an asset that is purely related to the income stream sees hotels come out significantly. I remember only in 2015 or something like that, when the Shangri-La in Sydney sold for circa $520,000 a key, and everybody went, oh my God, I can't believe that. You can't get into Sydney now for anything well above $1 million a key. So I think people will always continue to be on the sidelines looking for hotel transactions. Our biggest challenge is getting the stock to sell. And while they continue to sell substantially below replacement costs, I think we all agree we won't see this flurry of new supply coming into a market that we've seen in the last decade. I think there'll always be pent-up demand for hotels. Paul, do you agree?
I totally agree. I mean, there's massive capital that's coming to Australia, that is in Australia and it's coming to Australia. I mean, when I started out, it was very different. You know, yields were at 12% or even higher. I mean, interest rates were a little higher, but the amount of capital that's coming in and Australia becoming what it's become over the last sort of 20 years, there will always be demand for good assets. And I agree with Bunji, you know, hotels or the operators or owners do have the capability of really getting some shining prices compared to sort of other traditional fixed income style asset classes, which most real estate is, you know, commercial and retail, et cetera, industrial. But on the flip side, you can easily go the wrong way. And it obviously also depends on if you're planning on selling a hotel that you've just built, you know, do you sell the blue sky or do you take the risk of the trading environment? And the trading environment is not easy. It's not easy. And I don't think it's ever been easy. And at times it's unbelievably difficult. Like when September 11 happened, it was a little bit before my time. But as I said, GFC, we got through pretty easily in this country. But COVID is a perfect example. I mean, it just ripped apart the business. And then as things started to recover, as interest rates went up and cost of labor and energy and everything else, it's a bloody hard business. Not easy.
Yes. So a few rapid fire questions for you both to finish off. Paul, what's the best advice you've ever received?
The best advice? I can't think of one specific thing, but I've heard things over the years that have made me really think. To Bunzi's point before and the way that I've looked at coming in and out of deals, Nathan Rothschild supposedly, hundreds of years ago, but supposedly said to a question put to him, which was, what is the secret of his success? He said, I always sold too early. And I like that because if you believe, as I do, that there is always another opportunity, literally deals are like buses, but you have to believe that, and it's true. And the other one I think is a quote that I heard also from, I think it was Woody Allen who said it, that 80% of success is just showing up.
Yes.
And there's a deeper meaning behind that to me, but it basically says you've got to show up and you've got to ask for what you want. And if you don't show up and ask, you're definitely not going to get. And I think the rest of it is just grit and luck.
What about you, Wayne?
I always believe that what you put out in this world is what you get back. I mean, Paul talks about luck, and I was really lucky and fortunate that as a hotel GM, my hotel was sold and I became a hotel broker. And I've managed to meet so many amazing people like Paul. You know, it's a really lifelong journey. So I think it's all about what you put out in this world is what you get back. I think for being a successful property person, it's good if you can manage to hold on to everything you have. We all wish that. We all wish we still had the first house, the second house, the third house. We'd all be gazillionaires. But I think to Paul's point, I remember there was an industry stalwart called John Hudson when I was very young in hotel brokerage. And I remember him saying that we were a really good buyer, but we were terrible sellers. So I think there are, I see this a lot, greed. You know, during COVID, there was assets in regional locations that enjoyed the best trading periods they ever had. And you couldn't convince them to sell because they believed that that run would continue forever. No market runs forever. And if you can, you're never going to pick the highs, you're never going to pick the lows. But if you can absolutely try and get the tide, you won't get it at full tide. But if you can try and get the right tide, you can make a lot of money.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much for joining me again on Talking Property.
My pleasure, Catherine. I really want to thank Paul. You've become a really good friend, Paul. I love your loyalty to CBRE. I love your loyalty to me. I love your circle of friends who also share your loyalty and continued success to you, my friend. Congratulations.
Thank you, mate. The feeling is mutual, as you know, and hopefully we'll do many more. But if not, we remain great mates.
Well, thanks very much, Paul. It was really great to chat to you, and I can't wait to see what's next.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've got some great episodes coming up, so make sure to follow Talking Property wherever you get your podcasts. We'd also love it if you could rate or review Talking Property to help spread the word. And if you have any questions or feedback, you can drop me a note at any time by talkingproperty@cbre.com. Until next time.